Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Tom Cooper, whose new novel is Florida Man. We'll also hear from Loyola University professor Christian Bolden, whose new book is Out of the Red, My Life of Gangs, Prison, and Redemption. Tom Cooper made a splash 5 years ago with his first novel, The Marauders, set in the swamps of South Louisiana after the BP oil spill. In his much-anticipated second book, Florida Man, he focuses on his native state going back to the 1980s. Florida Man is topping must-read lists this season, and there's a good reason why. We're speaking to Tom today from his home here in New Orleans. Tom Cooper, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thanks so much, Susan. It's great to hear from you again. It's been a while.
Now, I am so happy you've been in New Orleans 10 years this year. So you're going to hang around now, I hope.
If they'll have me. I think the jury's still out on that.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I've waited five years for this book. And I have to say, it was totally worth it. Because
glad to hear that.
I can't remember the last time I enjoyed a book so much. I was gasping in surprise and shrieking with laughter, and I was so glad I was by myself and nobody was watching me read somewhere.
Oh, that's terrific to hear.
It would have been very embarrassing. Now, as usual for you, and we can say that now, you've put together an amazing band of misfits in a really interesting place called Emerald City, Florida. So tell us about inventing that place first.
Sure. Well, it was a kind of amalgamation of all the places that I love in Florida. And I was born and raised in Florida. I was born and raised in South Florida, which is a very different place now. So in a way, the book is kind of a homage to that bygone era of Florida, say the early 80s, right around when Disney World and Epcot kind of started to become really popular with tourists. And before, Florida was seen as a kind of a hokey place. You had all these kind of weird roadside attractions that you don't see much anymore. And it was definitely a more untamed place. So I wanted to kind of capture the Florida of my youth. And I wanted to do so in a kind of hyperbolic fashion. So this is pure Florida concentrate.
Mm-hmm.
And Emerald Island is based on a number of different places in Florida, mainly St. George, which is in the Panhandle. Marco Island is another place. St. Pete, Largo, specifically. I used to live in Largo on the beach in Florida some years ago. So it was a synthesis of all these different places and settings that I loved about Florida. So I tried to concentrate the essence of that place.
And you have a lot of Florida Man in this book. And you're aware of how Florida Man has become a cultural catchphrase of this moment. So read us a little bit about Florida Man from the beginning.
Sure. The Skull and the Sinkhole. It almost sounded like the beginning of one of those tall tales, one of those Florida Man stories Reed Crow was reading about all the time, especially lately. Florida Man beats chess opponent with brass knuckles after losing game. Florida Man urinates on uncle's coffin during funeral service. Florida Man caught fornicating in SeaWorld exhibit. Florida Man, coke-addled, calls 911 to ask for number for 911. Florida Man tries to conceal stolen ham and rectum, failed. Florida Man arrested for teaching parrot death threats made to IRS. Florida man armed with iguana robs herpetophobic mini-mart clerk.
And there you have it. There you have it. Now, Reed Crowe is one of those guys.
That's all me, by the way.
That's all you?
That's all me. That's why I moved to New Orleans, in fact. I think Florida was a bad influence.
Well, I don't know if New Orleans is a better influence. We'll have to see.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I've got my own New Orleans man thing going on now. So,
well, good. Good for you. That'll be the next book, New Orleans Man.
What's up?
Now, Reed Crowe operates an attraction called the Florida Man Mystery House. And it reminded me of that old place in Pensacola, the Museum of the Sea and Indian. And it sort of reeked of formaldehyde, and it was a little scary, and had the feeling somebody cleaned out their closet, you know, and put stuff on display. So talk a little bit about Reed and what he does and what his position is in life.
I think Reed Crowe is a consummate beach bum. He loves the place where he lives, and he's kind of stuck there, not only physically, but mentally. He's in a state of suspended animation, almost. And he cobbles together a living with various enterprises, moribund enterprises. He runs a shabby motel that's set on the beach, and he also has that roadside attraction that you mentioned. But he subsidizes his living and these enterprises with ill-gotten gain, which lands him into a bit of trouble. And the whole book really is about his choices. So it spans quite a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
It spans decades, which has thrown off some readers, I think, because a lot is crammed into the novel. It's structured, I think, in a very unconventional way. Perhaps it is conventional. I'm not aware of it, but there are some time jumps and what have you. And I think, you know, Reed Crowe is not based on anyone specifically, but definitely based on some of my relatives and some of my friends who have a tremendous affinity, inexplicable, to Florida and are just rooted there. Mm-hmm. They feel at home there. And I hope that despite the passage that we read, that the character is perceived as, yes, somewhat bumbling, somewhat inept and directionless, but not silly. You know, the MO, I had no MO with this book, but if I were to kind of pinpoint something close to one, it would be to have made a character, no matter how outlandish the situation, somewhat believable and empathetic, despite these kind of tabloid-like situation to get himself in.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Tom Cooper, whose new novel is Florida Man. Another wonderful character in this book is Henry Yachalane, and he is one of my favorite characters of all time. And one of the things I love about him is the way he's constructed his life, his family, even his remarkable house.
Yes, I'm so glad to hear that. And you know, I did want readers to wonder, well, is Reed Crowe ultimately the titular Florida man, or is it Wayne Wade, the jack of all trades and kind of villainous character in the book? I did want them to wonder about that.
Mm-hmm.
So Henry Yachalane originally had a much smaller part in the book, and like you, I fell in love with the character, as corny as that sounds. And I wanted him to play a large part, and I think he does in the book, not only in Reed Crowe's life, but later he becomes his own character, and we focus on him to a certain degree.
And then there's Catface, who's one of the most remarkable villains ever. Just,
I love Catface.
Scary to look at, scary to deal with, the whole thing. Read that little passage of Catface driving into Florida and what he sees on the way.
Well, this is Catface looking for Reed Crowe and trying to exact revenge for some long-ago ill-gotten gain. So he's driving through the spine of Florida, and he experiences Florida in its absolute quintessence. So the passage is this. Water parks and miniature golf courses and mermaid shows and high-life rondons. Boat tours and fishing charters. Jungle land, Indian casinos, strip clubs, seafood joints, monkey sanctuaries, myriad roadside oddities. He crossed the vast sawgrass prairies north of Miami and took I-75 north. The exits few and far between. The small communities with cookie-cutter stucco homes behind stucco walls, retention canals, and ponds like moats. Then the vast wilderness again. The jagged sawgrass marshes, their silhouettes reared against the twilight like black construction paper cut with toy scissors. The billboards, strip clubs, Asian spas, bungee jumping, scuba diving, deep sea fishing, spelunky, Walt Disney World, SeaWorld, the mermaids of Wickiwachi, a hand-painted billboard for a parrot circus where cockatoos and macaws perform stunts and tricks. "See Mr. Pecker live," said the sign, 3 exclamation marks. Seminole Indian casinos, High Lie, the monkey safari, the baboon lagoon, the serpentarium, the pirate tour of Gasparilla, swamp tours, snake hunts, the Florida Man Mystery House.
And just like that, trouble ensues.
Boy, that's a lot of stuff.
It is a lot of stuff.
That was a grocery list.
It reminded me of driving with my kids to Florida when they were little, back in the 80s and 90s.
So. Oh, sure. Exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah. So. Now, I have to say, I owe you for introducing me to a new and lovely word, Haxidi, which is something you're basically exploring in this book. And to quote, I think, the OED, the quality that makes a person, being, or thing describable is this, its thisness, the property that declares an entity's singularity, performs its individuation. And that's one of the great themes of this book, how Florida became Florida, how all these characters became their unforgettable selves. So what did you learn about all these things? What did you learn about your own Haxidi from writing this book?
Wow, that's a good question. You know, when I write a book, much of it is accidental, so much of it is serendipity. But I do think that given my background in Florida and my extensive history and my love for it and my affinity for the water, all the kind of, motley crew of characters in the state, you know, I don't think without those, this book would exist. And for that reason, I think it does distinguish itself from the other Florida company that I have.
Mm-hmm.
This is a different version of Florida from, say, Carl Hyacin or Harry Cruz, even. Kim Dorsey, I think, is another one. And Lauren Groff, who you mentioned, is just a tremendous short story writer. I've yet to delve into her novels, but I'm much looking forward to it. But my Florida is different from all those. And I wanted to encapsulate in some way, almost like a curio or a museum piece, a bygone Florida. This is the thisness of Florida in 1980 and beyond.
We've been talking with Tom Cooper, whose new book is Florida Man. Don't miss it. There's a marvel on every page. Tom, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's great to talk to you.
Christian Bolden is an associate professor in the Department of Criminology and Justice at Loyola University in New Orleans. His research centers on gang social networks and organizational processes, as well as human trafficking. He's worked as a research fellow for the FBI Behavioral Sciences Unit. Today, we're talking about his new book, his first, Out of the Red, My Life of Gangs, Prison, and Redemption. Christian Bolden, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
This is such an interesting book. It's such a combination of things. It's a memoir of your own life, but it's based on pretty rigorous scholarly research you've done, including interviews with 41 gang members, 1,009 letters you've sent or received in prison, and so much more. So talk about your approach to all this material.
Two things. I noticed, one, that there was a disconnect between academia and just people generally in the public.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of science denying and things like that, and I think that's because higher education has tended to sit on the outside for too long. So I wanted to create something that kind of bridges that gap.
Uh-huh.
And secondly, I noticed that, you know, we can throw all the data out to people, and unless someone's a numbers person, it doesn't mean a whole lot to them, but personal stories mean a whole lot. So weaving personal story with all of the academic information, you know, people get both at the same time. That's why I chose to go that route.
Now, your life has this amazing arc. You grew up in a trailer park outside San Antonio. You were a biracial child, a victim of school bullying, and you were part of a gang by the time you were 14. And an important part of this book talks about how young gang members are made.
Right. Yes, very early on. And I don't think people realize what's happening to them, but a lot of those things, that those drivers are set into motion at a very early age.
One of the interesting quotes from one of the other gang members you interviewed talks about how if you can incite an act of violence in a child, then that child has already been recruited.
Right. I felt that that was a pretty powerful quote as well. People learn very early on that violence in certain contexts earns them respect in the streets, and they become more and more desensitized to it. As it becomes a useful tool to them. And it's just this tragic process.
And you were also bounced around from school to school. And one of the things that your book brought home to me, it's probably an obvious point, but I hadn't really thought about it quite in this context before. When you were talking about how poverty in and of itself is one thing, but relative deprivation is another. And what it meant to be on a school bus, going to a school, going past houses where you would never live, seeing things that were out of reach, and how that creates a disconnect and a friction between people and whole groups of people.
Yes, absolutely. It's quite amazing, and it's very applicable to places like New Orleans, where you'll have mansions right next to streets where people are impoverished. And there's this tension that they're right over here, and they have things that I'm never going to obtain. And yes, it causes tension, and it causes people to be treated differently in very close settings. So it's very problematic.
And you said of your early life, the real problem is that we had no hope.
That's probably the biggest thing, is no hope that anything was going to change. When that's what you see around you, and you don't see paths out of it, people become very fatalistic. They don't think anything is going to get better, so they stop trying. They go with the flow. There is a Jesuit priest, Father Greg Boyle, who created this thing called Homeboy Industries out in California, which helps gang members transition to conventional life. And through all the years he's been operating, that is what he's found, is all that was really needed is the ability to give people hope,
mm-hmm.
because he found that that was the problem. They didn't have hope before.
Now, at 17, you were sentenced to 8 years in prison for assault with a deadly weapon. And one of the moving things about this book is the way you describe how you were bounced around from facility to facility all over Texas. You experienced sexual assault and violence, and you learned about prison gangs and the national kind of network of those gangs.
Yes. I don't think most people know that there's a whole underworld that exists almost parallel to conventional society, and gangs and organizations like that, they don't operate in a vacuum. There's relationships between the different groups, and it gets very complex and complicated, and they all have very interesting histories and how they came about and how those relationships have played out.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Loyola University professor Christian Bolden. His new book is Out of the Red, My Life of Gangs, Prison, and Redemption. One of the things that I just love about this is that you turned toward every opportunity that was offered to you. You explored your spiritual side. You converted to Christianity. You seized every educational opportunity you could. And you actually got a degree while you were incarcerated. What was it that gave you enough hope to do that? What was that moment that turned your life around?
I think there was a few things. One was looking up one day and just recognizing that a whole generation had been thrown away. There were all these other kids in there, 17, 18, 19-year-old youth that had very long sentences, and most of them were not going to be coming out anytime soon. And just deciding in that moment that this was not going to be my life. I wanted something different. And having or encountering people who gave me those opportunities or created those paths for me. For instance, I mentioned Jay Holland in there in his course, Basic Progress, which taught me that the only way forward for people in our situation was to be exceptional, to do things beyond what anybody could imagine. And I just decided to do that, to just keep going, to do everything I possibly could, and to not be defeated despite all of the things that were arrayed against me.
So finally you were paroled, and then came even more challenges. And you make those so vivid because it's such a trap. How are you supposed to make enough money to stay out of trouble and live your life, just an average American life right now?
Right. A lot of those very simple things, the curfew, you know, that sounds simple until you're stuck in traffic, things like that. You constantly had a different parole officer who had different viewpoints about what they expected of you. It was a trap. I think it's a trap for a lot of people, and it ends up causing them to get caught in a cycle.
Well, describe that moment when you go to that last meeting with that parole officer that you never met before and who didn't know you.
That was a very interesting moment because he read me the Riot Act. He was very strict and stern, telling me all of these expectations. He was pretty fierce. And then I calmly told him my success so far in school and having a job, and that this was my last actual parole meeting. And he was stunned.
Yeah.
Very, very stunned. He just, I don't think he could believe it. And, you know, I handed him the folder showing him all my documentation. And then he just broke out in a big grin and shook my hand and said, congratulations.
So I'm curious to know if writing this book had a healing effect on your life and your acknowledgments. You write about the birth of your son, Julian, during the writing of this book and how that got you through remembering some of these dark moments, because there is a lot of darkness in this book.
There's a lot of darkness. It was very, very hard. It was an emotional roller coaster. My son had just been born, and I held him in one hand and typed with the other hand almost half of this book. And, you know, anytime it just became too overwhelming, you know, just just cuddle him and, you know, things would be all right.
Got your priorities straight. That's for sure. Well, this is such an amazing story, and I am so glad you're here to tell it. We've been talking with Loyola University Professor Christian Bolden, whose new book is Out of the Red, My Life of Gangs, Prison, and Redemption. It will open your eyes to so many things. Christian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Garden District Bookshop presents Greg Mania in a Zoom conversation with Juno Morrow, celebrating his book, Born to be Public, a memoir. Tuesday, October 6th at 6. For details, visit GardenDistrictBookshop.com. Stephen Salvatore, a young adult author, educator, and Star Wars fanatic, whose debut YA novel, Can't Take That Away, will be published next March, will be the virtual cocktail hour guest Friday, October 9th at 5, live on the Garden District Bookshop Facebook page. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.